Our first case for argument this morning is McCarter against the Retirement Plan of American Family Insurance. Ms. Bierstein.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Andrea Bierstein. I represent the plaintiffs in this appeal. Our position in this appeal is that the court below erred in granting summary judgment, whether you view it as a matter of standing or on the merits, because the plans here were in violation of ERISA in that they imposed a significant detriment on the choice to defer benefits until normal retirement age.
I have one initial question about your concept of the detriment, because it seems to me that your clients had more choices than other sets of people. So it strikes me that your clients are, in fact, trying to raise third-party rights, not their own rights. They had plenty of options.
The problem here isn't that they didn't have options. The significant detriment was on the road not taken. That is,
but not for them. They could either take the full payout or the lump sum. They could defer. It's other people who couldn't get the lump sum.
The way the regulation is structured, the point of the significant detriment rule, what the rule says is that the consent to early distribution isn't valid if there would be a significant detriment on deferral. That is, we say...
So where's the detriment on a deferral for your clients?
Had they deferred, they would not have been able to get a lump sum. That was a detriment.
They could not
get a lump sum by deferring. So what the plan...
They couldn't retire and just say, we're going to wait and see whether we want a lump sum.
That's correct, but
and
the
that's,
way...
And the interest of the plan... So how long did this option have to stay open in your view? Sort of for the rest of their life or?
Until normal retirement age.
Where does it say that in any regulation?
It says it in ERISA in two ways. You have to look at the statute and the regulation together. The statute starts off by saying that if you have a benefit more than $5,000, The benefit cannot be immediately distributed without the consent of the participant. That is, the plan must allow you to wait until normal retirement age to get your benefit.
I understand that, and they consented, and they're happy with their consent.
The
issue is an amazing position, actually, that you have here, since you're not only arguing that even though they consented to the lump sum, somehow their consent was tainted, but you're saying they get to keep that lump sum and get another new lump sum that's the or annuity that's the actuarial equivalent. I don't know in what universe ERISA requires these things.
The issue of the remedy, I think, is separate from the issue of the violation, because the defendants could have claimed the offset, and we would be arguing about whether they're entitled to that. And I want to put that aside for one moment, because I think the question of the remedy is quite distinct here from the violation.
It's only related in that both of neither position, it seems to me, is grounded in ERISA, as I read ERISA.
I understand that, but to the extent that Your Honor has difficulties with it, I think they are two separate issues. Coming back to the question of the violation, what the regulation says is that consent...
I don't understand the premise of your argument. The regulation to which you're referring is, I gather, an interpretation of the Internal Revenue Code rather than ERISA. Is that right?
Well, not exactly, because the regulations are cross-adopted. That is, you have the parallel provisions of ERISA and the code, which are identical, and then the regulations, and we cite this in our brief, because it's administered jointly by the Department of Labor and the Department of the Treasury, and the regulations are cross-adopted.
Here's my problem. Perhaps you can address it directly. It looks to me like this regulation is saying that unless a particular requirement is met, a plan is not tax qualified. That is, it doesn't qualify for deferral of income. But there are all sorts of plans that are perfectly legal and not tax qualified. You appear to be saying that any plan that is not tax qualified is also not lawful. And that's not my understanding of ERISA. So I'm interested in knowing what you think is the basis of that link.
It is not our position that any plan that's not tax qualified, it violates ERISA. But the statute, which is not merely the code, but ERISA itself, says that benefits may not be distributed without consent. That is a violation.
That I understand, but your clients consented. There's no problem there.
The issue is whether
the only provision that's in ERISA is one that's also in the plan. Your clients consented. There's no problem. So I'm totally lost about what you think the problem is.
We think
unless it's that a plan is not lawful unless it's tax qualified.
Our position is that consent has to be valid. That their consent was invalid.
I can't see any basis on which the consent was invalid. This is a perfectly normal contract. You don't say anybody pointed a gun at your clients. They just had a choice, and they made it.
It would eviscerate the provision in ERISA that says you can't. Plans always want to distribute early because it shifts the investment risk and gets rid of the administrative hassle.
I actually think you may be wrong about that. I think it depends a lot on the plan's own assessment of whether it wants to manage a defined benefit plan in the future, whether it's got the liquidity to give a lump sum payment right now as opposed to managing things in the other way. I think your assumption on that may not be empirically accurate.
Whether or not it is, I think the issue is that if a plan, the statute, we're not talking about the regulation, the statute says you cannot distribute without consent. If a plan could say, okay, we won't distribute without consent, but if you don't take it, we're going to do the following things to you. We can think about a continuum of ways to push people to make a particular choice. What does consent mean if the plan could say, well, okay, we won't distribute without consent, but if you don't consent, we're going to cut your benefits in half. If you don't consent, we're going to dock you $100,000. If you don't consent, to say that the notion
of... They haven't done anything like that. Your view is that the plan also can't in any way sweeten the deal and say, if you do consent, we'll give you this money right now, all in a big lump sum so that you can invest it. If you think you can do better than the plan's investment, you have the choice of doing that.
ERISA says, as I read it, that the plan cannot put its thumb on the scale. That is, it
Where
can
does
get
it
your...
Say con- that?
Say that.
Well, the regulation certainly says that.
You are reading a tax regulation having to do with tax qualification of the plan back into ERISA, and I can't see the basis of that.
Even without the regulation, what would the point of the non-consent rule be if the plan could bribe you to do what it wants?
But they see, say what you can't you're do doing is you are divorcing the concept of consent, or at least I'll say
yes.
You have a very specialized notion of what consent is. I can tell you that consent itself is something that needs to be evaluated against a backdrop. In contract law, consent simply means, you know, you take the set of pluses and minuses of the contract that are in front of you and decide whether to contract. If it's a Fourth Amendment, did you consent to the search of your car? You basically have to be standing there. I mean, it's a very liberal notion of consent. Here in this area, there could well be a rule under Title 26 and 26 CFR that specifies the attributes of consent for tax qualification, which might not be the same as ordinary contract consent.
The regulation at issue is not merely about tax qualification.
But it's 26 CFR section 1.411A, right?
It is, Your Honor, but as we noted in our briefs, and I can come up with the regulation site, there's specific statutory and regulatory authority that the regulations adopted by the IRS for interpreting the parallel provisions are also applicable back as if adopted by DOL and vice versa. It is not simply a tax regulation because ERISA doesn't work that way. There were two separate agencies that have authority for it, and they cross-adopt each other's regulations. So the notion that this is only a tax regulation...
It's a regulation about taxation. It doesn't matter how many cabinet secretaries adopt a regulation about taxation. It's still a regulation about taxation.
I beg to disagree, Your Honor. It's a regulation about consent. It says that consent is not valid under certain circumstances, and it's a reference back to the same statute.
Do you think that any plea bargain in federal court is voluntary?
I think
the prosecutor comes to the defendant and says, Here's a bargain. You can take it now before the trial begins. If you don't take it now, the bargain is off the table. And what you have is your right to a trial by jury. Defendant takes the bargain. Can he appeal and say this bargain was involuntary because the prosecutor said it would vanish if rejected and could not be taken later?
He could not, but the policies of ERISA are different. ERISA exists for the specific purpose of guaranteeing retirement security. It's supposed to protect retirees not only from their employers, but also from themselves. And the when the IRS looked at the same statutory provision that is the law and is not merely a tax qualification, it said consent is not valid if you put a significant detriment on one of the choices. And
I know
that's
you're
a different
in your
set
rebuttal
of policies.
Time, but I'm going to also point out that even if everything you say is correct about the cross applicability of this regulation, it doesn't say any detriment, however trivial. It says a significant detriment. And I just want to note that, since I have a difficult time seeing how the choice given to your clients amounted to anything significant in the way of detriment.
We think the loss of a lump sum option is a significant detriment.
They didn't lose
detriment.
A lump sum option. They got their lump sum.
They lost the they would have lost it if they deferred. The problem here isn't that there was a loss of a lump sum. It was the loss of the right to defer that they lost. And they lost it because of the detriment that would have been placed on them by exercising that option. They lost the chance to get their benefits when they retire, when they would be in a better position to make a wiser choice about their retirement.
Early retirement programs are invalid under ERISA. An early retirement program is something that must be taken now, can't be deferred, and if you say no, well, you get your regular retirement benefits later when they're due.
Most early retirement plans do not typically mean you have to take the benefits now. It means you leave, you separate from the company now.
You have to make an election right at this instant, and it cannot be deferred.
As I understand it, the receipt of benefits can be deferred in a typical early retirement. It's the receipt of benefits that ERISA is concerned about. ERISA doesn't say you can't, that a company can't cause you to retire immediately without consent. It says it can't distribute your benefits immediately without consent. It's the idea. It can give you a program as an incentive to get you out of the company and open up space for other employees or do whatever it wants, but it cannot distribute your benefits to you immediately without consent, and it cannot obtain your consent by saying if you don't consent, the benefits you get later will be worse in some way.
So you think your clients would have been better off if these plans had not been amended in 1997 to add the lump sum option? I think that's unequivocally the implication of your argument.
Absolutely. Of course they would have
been
better off.
They wouldn't have gotten any lump sums. They just would have gotten an annuity at retirement, just as they would now if they turned down the lump sum.
They would have been insured of benefits in their old age,
only in the annuity format, which they were free to choose under this plan as well.
What ERISA is concerned with making sure that people have money in their old age when they're too old to work. Had there never been a lump sum option, they would have been better off because when they get to be 78 years old and they can't work, they would not be out of money because they would have been insured of a retirement benefit. The concern here is that by pushing people out of the plan to take their benefits before they reach retirement age, you've diminished the security of their retirement, the guarantee of a secure retirement. Now, ERISA doesn't make that 100% watertight because come normal retirement age, you can always make a poor choice. You can always misinvest your money. You can always run out of money. But ERISA is trying to diminish those chances by saying you're not supposed to make that choice till normal retirement age, and B, if you do it before normal retirement age, it has to be on an even scale, no thumb on the scale. What the company did was say, no, we're going to make it so attractive for you to take early distribution, and that diminishes the security of every retiree's retirement plan.
Okay.
Well, I see the warning light is on, so if you... I don't know how much of my time I still have.
You have a minute left.
Was that my rebuttal?
20 seconds left.
20 seconds.
Thank you.
Mr. Smith.
Good morning. My name is Todd Smith of the Godfrey & Kahn Law Firm in Madison, Wisconsin. With me at counsel today, table today and also arguing today is my partner, Kendall Harrison, and we represent the American Family Defendants, the appellees in this case. I will address the issues of standing as well as the merits of the case, showing why the ERISA plans in this case impose no significant detriment on the appellants, and Mr. Harrison will address why the district court's award of attorney's fees should be affirmed.
Mr. Smith, I had a question for you about standing, which is really why this case ought to be decided on standing grounds. The district judge recognizes that this is an area where, as she put it, more or less, standing bumps into the merits pretty closely, and I would say perhaps all the way, since the allegations the plaintiffs have made, whatever you may think of the theory, portray an injury in fact, and if somebody's going to lose, it's not really because they didn't claim they had an injury, and they could get more money, and so it could be redressed. Why shouldn't we just go ahead and look at the merits of this case?
That would be one way to resolve this case, and Judge Crabb was correct, as is often the case, that merits and standing issues merge. But I would take one issue with what you said, which is that there's also another basis for not finding standing. That is their deposition testimony, which establishes that today they don't want the relief that they're suing to seek. Today they've received their lump sum payments, and they've testified.
No, they want two lump sum payments.
They
want a lump sum payment plus a full retirement benefit later. Now, they may not be entitled to that, but I don't see why that's a shortfall in standing. It suggests that they just want a windfall. Lots of people want a windfall. It's not a standing problem.
I do agree with your characterization, not only of the issue, but of their claim. And I would just suggest you can't, but I would suggest that you can't create standing by asking for something the law plainly doesn't allow you to have. Well, because
on your view, wouldn't every case in which the plaintiff loses end with the line, plaintiff doesn't have the legal rights she asserts, therefore the case is dismissed for want of standing? It ends with judgment for defendant.
Your point is well
taken. As you would hope, because if it's dismissed for want of standing, they can sue you again.
Understood. Your point is well taken that the issues do merge. I think the issue, the way this case developed, Your Honor, is that once they received their clients, the appellants here testified that they didn't in fact want the relief that they had sued for. They came up with this alternative double dip lump sum theory in order to escape their standing problem. That issue is apparent in the briefs as well. The plaintiffs, the appellants, Your Honor, allege that they were victims of nothing short of bribery and coercion, and the undisputed facts we submit show that it is simply not so. American Family offers, as we have established, two pension plans for its employees. They offer a variety, in fact, a full panoply of traditional annuity options for participants. In 1997, the plans were amended to give participants new and additional and very favorable options for participants, including the lump sum.
Mr. Smith, could I ask you just a factual question? The record indicates that some 90% of the people in this group do opt for the lump sum payment, and this is the group of people, I take it, who, A, do not retire at age 65 after a full career with the company, and, B, don't qualify for that early retirement. You know, you've been there 15 years and you've reached the age of 50 or something like that. So these are people who work more than 5 years, so they've vested, but they don't qualify. Is that the set we're talking about?
I think anybody can take a lump sum.
And
whether they do so is up to them.
So even the people who retire at 65 can take a lump sum?
Yes. The lump sum option is a favorable option for participants. It offers them greater flexibility, and I think things that we're all familiar with about enhanced beneficiary designations and investment options. American Family was under no obligation to offer this benefit to its participants, but it did after careful and deliberate and responsible consideration as a company. and it offered this at an additional cost to itself. The appellants were all terminated from American Family, and they all had all of the options under the plans for taking their benefits. Their options were clearly and accurately described to them in the plan documents and in the materials they received upon termination, and they all took their lump sum and they received their full value, the correctly calculated value of their benefit.
It seems to me, under reading your briefs, that your assumption was that, you know, if they retire, let's say, at age, or they're terminated at age 52, that they might have wanted to elect a lump sum at any time between age 52 and age 65. And I understand Ms. Bierstein's point to be, no, they were willing to wait until age 65 and take whatever market risks or other kinds of risks there were, but they wanted to be able to elect a lump sum then. Is that your understanding of their position?
I'm not sure of their position, their litigation position, Your Honor, but I am familiar with what the appellants said in their deposition testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Their position there is they wanted the ability to take a lump sum at any time,
at any time of their choosing.
They wanted to be able to say, I think they wanted to have the ability to say, I think interest rates are really low right now, I'm going to take a lump sum, therefore get a bigger payment of a lump sum. Something that would clearly hurt the financial viability of the plans to the detriment of all participants. Proving that no theory, despite the fact that they all the appellants in this case received their lump sum payments that they concede was clearly explained to them and correctly calculated, they subsequently sued American Family, asserting in their pleadings at least that they were coerced or bribed into making this decision, the decision that had to be made within 3 months. And not only do they want the ability to take a lump sum again or a benefit in a different form again at their choosing, at a date of their choosing, they also want to keep the first lump sum. They believe they're entitled to this, even though not one of them testified that they wanted to revisit their benefit election decision. And we submit these facts foreclose their legal theory. There is no factual basis for the proposition, as we've already discussed today, that simply having to make a choice within a certain amount of time is somehow coercive or overcomes their will, so that they had to take the lump sum for fear of these terrible traditional annuity options that were their alternative if they let the deadline pass. We submit there's no evidence in the record to support that, whether it be on standing grounds or on the merits. And if Your Honors have no other questions or would like to hear on a different topic, I can have my partner address the attorney's fee issues.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Henderson.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Kendall Harrison, and I'm here to briefly address the attorney's fees issue this morning. This is a case that should never have been filed. Because it was, however, American Family has had to expend considerable resources defending against it. Fortunately, ERISA has a fee-shifting provision, 29 U.S.C. Section 1132G, that allows a district court to make a defendant whole when it has had to deal with misconceived lawsuits such as this one. Here, we asked the district court for our fees, and the court granted them, finding that this was, quote, precisely the kind of case for which Section 1132G was intended.
But if we were to decide the fee issue right now, I take it the district court has not reduced its ruling to any specific number because this appeal was filed. So we could conceivably be looking at another appeal on the ground that the fees were too high or awarded things that were non-compensable or something.
It is true that the district court has not reduced the precise amount of the fee award to one number. We have submitted numbers to the court, but what she has found is simply at this point that we are entitled to our fees. What happened was that a notice of appeal was filed before the court had the ability to deal with that.
Well, a notice of appeal from a non-appealable judgment doesn't bring anything up. You know, the Supreme Court decided, reiterated, I might say, just yesterday, that a decision is not final if it entails a financial award until the amount has been quantified and is therefore not appealable. So what's there to do on the fees question?
Well, Your Honor, under this court's decision in Lorillard Tobacco and Kokomo Tube, it is our position that the court has said that in situations where a fee award has been, well, in a situation where a district court has determined that a party is entitled to fees, that it's appropriate for the Court of Appeals at that point, when it's also considering the merits of the case, to take up the issue of whether fees were appropriate or not.
And what do you think we should do about Supreme Court cases saying that it is just not final and not appropriate for a Court of Appeals to do something when the amount has not been quantified?
Well, I haven't had an opportunity to review that decision, but obviously you
have. Yesterday's decision. It's cases like Liberty Mutual against Wetzel from 1976. I mean, the Supreme Court says this over and over. What do you think we should do?
Your Honor, again, the cases of this court, I think, make it clear that this court has the jurisdiction to consider whether attorney's fees are appropriate or not in a situation where it's also considering the merits of the case, as it is here today.
But I don't see what you stand to gain, frankly, even the Supreme Court to one side. I mean, you would like, I assume, some statement that says, in principle, fees are awardable, but you know, you have that already from the district court. And since, as I pointed out, there is still room for disagreement. There frequently is disagreement on the details of fee and cost awards. You can't really avoid another appeal no matter what. I mean, I just, from a very practical point of view, it's hard for me to see what you gain.
It is true that we would have to be back in front of the district court arguing to her about the precise amount.
And possibly up here.
I don't think we can avoid that possibility. So if the court decides that it wishes to save that issue for another day, then that's the court's prerogative. But I do think that it would help the parties in determining the future scope of this litigation to have a decision affirming the district court's position on attorney's fees today, rather than another year down the road.
I don't even see how, in principle, one can affirm a declaration that somebody is entitled to recover when there has been no decision specifying how much he recovers. It would be like affirming a district court's opinion on liability when damages remain to be determined.
Your Honor, I'm not able to answer this question in a way other than I've already answered it with respect to the Kokomo Tube decision and the Lorillard decision. Your Honors, if you do end up taking up the issue, this is clearly a situation where there was no abuse of discretion by the district court. ERISA, well, Section 1132G, presumes that there will be fee shifting in a situation where one party loses unless that losing party can show that its claims were substantially justified. Here, the plaintiffs were not able to show that to the district court, and the court did not abuse its discretion in reaching that conclusion. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Kirstein, you have about 20 seconds.
I do have 20 seconds. Mr. Smith says that the lump sum option is a favorable one, and I would ask, if it's favorable, how can it not be a detriment to take it away from participants who would choose to defer? If that's used up my 20 seconds, then unless there are further questions, I'll sit down.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.